fantastic. All right.
Okay, everybody come on in. Okay, I'm going to jump right in because we have 40 minutes. So today's sex, drugs, rock and roll. So we're going to talk about sex. Talk about sex, baby, right? Why would somebody, now remember, you're being taught this by a therapist, so I do need to explain why would somebody see a therapist for sex therapy. And it's kind of funny because I just have to say, people will say, so what do you do exactly? And I'm like, well, everything in my office is physically G-rated and verbally X-rated. So we don't do anything. Well, okay, sometimes maybe PG-rated because I do touch exercises, meaning touch your hands exercises. But people come to me for a number of different issues. They do come for sexual trauma, for sexual abuse, and so on. They also come for sexual dysfunction, or they're just having problems in their sexual relationship, their sexual trauma, sexual dysphoria, which would be gender dysphoria, and we'll talk about that, and for sexual addiction. So those are some of the reasons why people come to see a sex therapist. So this is straight out of the DSM. I just want to explain them to you. The female sexual dysfunctions are genitopelvic pain penetration disorder, which I've told you, gosh, that's a really long name. It just means that during the process of intercourse, it's painful. Female orgasmic disorder, meaning either I've had an orgasm and I'm not having them now, or I've never had one. And then female sexual interest arousal disorder, I'm not interested in sexuality, or when we do start, my body doesn't respond with arousal. Male sexual dysfunction is erectile dysfunction, the inability or the difficulty with maintaining or obtaining erection. Premature ejaculation, having an orgasm too soon, or it feels like it's too soon. Delayed ejaculation, continuing in intercourse and not ejaculating, and then low desire for men. So I have a mixed audience today. We're not going to go into all of the details here, but it's really important that it's not inappropriate to talk about the realities of these things, because let me tell you, the singles and campus and teen students ask me these questions when I have workshops with them. We have to talk openly about sexuality. Hello, we have a whole book in the Bible dedicated to it, right? So we have to figure out how to talk openly within our families and within our churches. The place we should be able to talk the most openly about sex is within our families and within our church. What is the spiritual view of sex? This is, out of Ezekiel 16 and 23, we see that sexuality is designed by God as a way to know God more fully. Let me explain what I mean by that. In 16 and 23, God is talking about the nation of Israel and how they are committing idolatry. They're worshiping other gods. But guess how he explains it? He uses the language of adultery, and he does it in vivid detail over and over. In 16 and 23, he talks about fondling their breasts, and in 23 he talks about that their emissions were like those of donkeys and their genitals were what? He uses really explicit sexual language in Ezekiel 16 and 23, and he's not even talking actually about sex, he's talking about the nation of Israel. Well, he's using the language of adultery to explain idolatry. Why? Well, some of the greatest pains that people experience is when there has been infidelity or unfaithfulness in their married relationship. And we get that. The idea, or maybe you've seen your parents and one of them was unfaithful, or you've seen people around you, or you've had previous partners, or it's happened in your relationship. The pain of unfaithfulness and infidelity is immeasurable, right? And God goes, that's how I feel, because he gets it. He wants to use language we understand, and he wants us to know him. He wants us to know his heart. He wants us to know his character. So he uses language we understand. He uses the language of sexuality so that we can know him. That's just amazing. Okay, so God, he wants us to know him. So sexuality, though, it's not a surprise that he uses sexual language to express himself, because he does that in all physical things. You know, that the mountains shout, the trees clap their hands, the rocks cry out. What's he talking about? He's saying all of creation shouts. He uses the physical to express the spiritual over and over in the scriptures. And then ultimately, Jesus was incarnated into a physical body. Jesus was made physical so that we could know God. So God uses the physical to explain the spiritual. He uses the sexual to explain the spiritual. You know, sexuality can be a language where God can explain things to us. The ecstasy of orgasm is actually the word for sex in the New Testament is to know. And I'll explain that in a second. It's the same word where God says, what is eternal life? To know God. It's the same word. So I always joke, the ecstasy of orgasm is God trying to explain how incredibly awesome heaven's going to be. You know, God uses sexual language to help us get things, right? So here's to know. Matthew, it says that Joseph did not engage in sex. It actually means he did not gnosko Mary. He did not know her until after Jesus was born. This word to know is actually in John 10, where I know the sheep and the sheep know me. I know the Father and the Father knows me. It's the same word. The word that's used to describe that, how well does God know you? Pretty well. He made you, right? We covered that earlier. How well do Jesus and God know each other? Well, Jesus is God, so probably pretty well, right? That depth of intimate knowing, and he says, I know the sheep and the sheep know me. He knows us. That depth of intimate knowing, he knit us while we were in our mother's womb. That depth of intimate knowing is the word he uses for the sexual relationship between Joseph and Mary. Isn't that interesting? It's not because the knowing between Jesus and God is sexual. It's because that depth of intimate knowing is what's supposed to be happening in sex. And that's not what's happening in sex. You know, whether it's pornography, whether it's extramarital affairs, there's not a depth of intimate knowing that's occurring. And if it is, it doesn't end up very well, right? God intends that for that marital relation, that depth of intimate connection. That's what sex is actually supposed to be like. Well, it's really interesting because when it says Adam and Eve, Adam knew Eve. It's the same word in Hebrew. Adam yada Eve in Genesis 4. So it's the, and then later in Jeremiah 31, it says, I will be their God and they will know me. Yada. They will yada me. So exactly like you see in both Old and New Testament, the word to know, which means the depth of intimate knowing, is the word used to describe the sexual relationship. Why? Because that's what sex. So when people ask me, should I engage in this kind of behavior? Should I do this? Well, does it fit in the intimate connection that God created sexuality to be about? It's not about orgasm. It's about intimate connection with the other that you have a covenant relationship with. That's actually the only place in the Bible that sex is supposed to occur, is in that depth of intimate knowing. And then, like we talked about earlier, that knowing guards and guides our sexuality, right? So it's a good idea to know who God is, and that will help us decide what kind of sexual things to engage in. These are the other words that are used all throughout the scriptures, that sex is honorable, that sex causes intoxication. Ooh, here we're crossing over between sex and drugs, which, let me tell you, they cross over a lot. But it literally says in Proverbs that when the husband looks at his wife's breasts, he starts to go, right? And I bet some of you who are single have read that verse and gone, oh my gosh, what's that talking about? That's talking about how that's how good sex should be. Okay, so we need to be teaching our teens and our campus and our singles that the Bible uses incredibly sex-positive words. When it's good, and when it's in God's plan, in a marital sexual relationship, it should. And let me tell you, there's plenty of married people who, when I show these words, they're like, that's not what happened in my marriage. So that should be happening. Because the other word in Corinthians, Paul says that the guy who's supposed to be engaged and he's burning for her, the one he's engaged to, and so they should go get married. So where's the burning supposed to happen? In the marriage relationship. It's supposed to be like, woo, I'm on fire. Well, sometimes that's not happening in marriage relationships, and that is where it's supposed to occur. The reeling is the intoxicating, and also all throughout Song of Solomon and Proverbs, there's all these scriptures that talk about water and a deep well and a flowing stream. So the water images are all throughout the scriptures on sexuality. So sex should be refreshing and wonderful and beautiful, right? Are we talking to our children about these words? Are we talking to our singles ministries about these words? And where do you place these? It's all pleasurable and good. So then where do we do the actual, what you would call erotic sexuality, where you're engaged and leading to orgasm? God's plan is that that's within the marital sexual relationship. So as a church, we tend to address sexuality only when it's involving sin. Oh my gosh, I'm not going to let you look at the rest. So this is so huge. We only talk about sin in connection with sexuality. We don't talk about sexuality, about what is it and how does it work and the goodness of it. We talk about it when somebody's involved in pornography and when they're in an affair or, you know, some kind of sexual trauma has come up. We might talk about it then, and even then we don't talk about that one very well. We have got to figure out as a church how to talk about sin. Okay, somebody said to me, Jennifer, we need to do one of these classes on sexuality on... Jennifer, I was listening to you, and we need to do the one on sexual addiction, and I'm like, yes, we do need to talk about sexual addiction, but no, I'm not going to do a class on sexual addiction. I'm going to do a class on sex, and I will include sexual addiction, but if we don't teach sex correctly, then we are, it's like the whole preventative thing, if you don't eat right, you're going to get sick, you know, we've got to understand sex in God's plan, so that then when we're trying to recover from sexual addiction, we've got somewhere to ground ourselves, to be rooted in. We have to talk openly about sex. We don't know how to talk about it with children. Okay, I'm just going to say something. How am I? So James, you guys are here, and we've had some elders here off and on. I sat with the elders last week about a very serious situation. I said, okay, I have your full attention, so I'm going to say something. I've been asking to talk to all the families about how to teach their children about sex, and we need to do it yesterday. Just want to let you know. So honestly, it's a huge need. These things are huge. So, and that's when I say go read the book. We tend towards shaming sexual sin instead of figuring out what's behind it. Often the teachings within churches are negative, sex negative. We don't deal with the feelings of shame and guilt very well. We don't actually even deal with the enticement very well out of James 1. We avoid talking about masturbation, pornography, and same-sex attraction. Thank God for Guy Hammond. And we don't do a great job of teaching about sexual relationships as God intends. So as a church, we really have some changes. And I know I'm preaching to the choir probably about this, right? Okay, so let me teach you some things about sex. I get this question. This is from my singles workshops. This question, does sex hurt and should sex hurt? These are two questions out of a singles workshop I did. They want to know. And we should be talking about it. We should be talking about it. And so this was actually a question that one of my kids asked me not too long ago this last year, and we had a really long conversation. Not a long, no, because they don't want to have a long conversation, but we had a conversation about it. We had a conversation about the realities of, well, for some people it does, for some women it does, for many it doesn't. Actually, for some men it can be painful for various reasons. And so we had a conversation about it. Like, we have to be able to talk about the realities that a lot of married women, this is what they're experiencing. And just a little tidbit, if that's the case, come see me. There's a great sexual medicine specialist literally down the road from here who I refer a lot of people to. And there are people in this room who would tell you that he has healed them from 30 years of sexual pain. So it's just really important to realize this doesn't have to be somebody's story. This is what they come and see me for. If you're asking what does Jennifer do as a sex therapist, this is one of the things she deals with, is with pain. It's vital to realize that, yes, there is a body involved in sex. Sometimes it can be painful, and sometimes people have a problem with erection, and we have to understand arousal and how it works. So arousal, which is where the female vagina throbs or the male penis becomes erect, is actually called it's actually a knee-jerk reaction, which means it's controlled by the lower spine, the initial response. In other words, you know, when you have that flash of a thought and immediately you get an arousal reaction in the penile region or a throbbing to the vagina, that's actually blood flow. It's a God-created sexual response. It's a God-created sexual response that is preparing you to have and enjoy sex. That, yeah, we don't want to expose ourselves to pornography, so we get that God-created response. But it's important that sometimes we shame that initial response. Yeah. That you felt aroused, you must be in sin. When in all actuality, you can't control the initial response. I had somebody at one of my workshops say, so when does it go from being controlled by the lower spine to being controlled by the brain? I said, pretty much instantly. But I'm just saying that initial response, your brain isn't even involved in it. Because when I work with couples, and I worked with a couple, they're sitting there watching TV, a Victoria's Secret commercial comes on. She looks over, because she's really angry about his use of pornography. She looks over and she sees that he's got a slight erection and she's furious. And I talked about how it's important to realize that initial response is controlled not by the, oh, I want to get aroused right now, that just the flash of a thought creates it. Now, what do we do with it? Okay, so the body is made this way. Oh my gosh, I had 500 women yelling at the top of their lungs, my vagina is awesome, up in LA last year. It was so fun. But we do need to go, wow, my sexual body is awesome. Now, what do I do with it? We have to accept arousal. We have to understand it. It's blood flow. It's blood flow that's connected to our central nervous system. And it's actually pretty cool. Like, we should go, wow, look at that. That's so amazing. Now, I'm not going to go and arouse myself to orgasm. I'm going to go take a walk or a cold shower or whatever, or take my mind somewhere else or go read a scripture and bring in my beliefs on how to respond to that, because I don't actually want to. This is for those who are single and you don't have a partner to say, hey, come on. The reality is we have to understand it and accept it as a God-given response, because that will help a ton in the process of dealing with pornography and sexual addiction. Is that, and okay, we talked about how to accept those negative thoughts about self when you have an anxious thought, right? And how to go, ah, there it is. That's exactly what I teach people to do with arousal. Ah, there it is. I have women who have PGAD, which is persistent general arousal disorder, where, and there's men that have it, where they do not want that arousal. They are not doing anything to get that arousal happening. It's actually a pain disorder. They have, and people will say, oh, lucky you, you're having 6 to 8 orgasms a day. No, no, no. It's incredibly debilitating. So I have had, actually, since I've been talking about it with the church, I've had several individuals come to me and say, nobody's ever explained, this is what happens to me. Out of the blue, I'll get this boof, orgasmic response in the middle of the day at work. And you think, yeah, and people are like, well, lucky you. No, it's very distressing, especially if they have religious beliefs, and people are telling them, what are you doing? And so I said, well, what would it be like for you to just go, ah, there it is. My body just does this. I'm not quite sure why. I might need to go see, because it could be a pain disorder, and she actually could have some things connected with it. But what would it be like, instead of having this guilty, I'm horrible, I'm awful response, how about, there's that response that my body does, and okay, I'm just going to talk with it. And she did. She's not, know what she's doing now. She's telling people, you know, that are close to her about, this is what happened this today, and they're talking openly. So without giving all the spiritual details, I stood up in a conference and I shared this. It was a sexuality conference, and I said, you know, that I was teaching somebody that I was working with how to just go, ah, there it is. Because what happens is when anxiety gets attached, then you end up with a pretty serious disorder later on. And so I was sharing this, and this woman stood up and said, you need to tell her to go see a specialist. And I was like, I did. And then I went on. But later, this other woman came up to me and said, I just have a question. What's the technical term for, ah, there it is? And I said, well, there really isn't one. I think that's a term I just kind of, and then I went, oh, wait, sorry. Yes, there is. It's called distress tolerance. There actually, in psychology, is a term called distress tolerance. And when something distresses you, learning how to tolerate it instead of react to it, right? So we've been talking a lot about that in the last couple classes. But you have to also do that with sexuality. Ah, there it is. And now I'm going to pull in my beliefs on how to respond to arousal. So what else do people see me for? They come and see me for sexual trauma. There's gosh, just not enough time to talk in detail about that. But the other thing that comes up is that the trauma response will happen in the middle of someone's day. It'll happen with their spouse when they're married. It'll happen in the middle of a beautiful, godly, sexual, spousal moment during sex. And so one of the things that I do is I work with individuals, with couples, on how to deal with what you call the same PTSD response that occurs when someone's gone to war. And we've talked about that, right? It occurs for some people throughout the day regarding their sexual trauma. And it'll come, and it'll happen right in the middle of sex. And so this question came up, again, in my singles workshop. This is my background. This is the trauma I have. I'm worried about when I get married, will this be a problem with my spouse? And I said, good for you asking it now. Because yes, you can get help with that now rather than waiting till then. Now the reality is you'll probably also need to get help then. So sexual trauma comes up quite a bit in the work that I do. And I think it's very just real for those of us even just sitting here. And so sometimes people have to get involved in trauma therapy. I do trauma therapy, but there's many different kinds. And then how do you have, especially if the sexual trauma has happened in the marriage, which that absolutely happens, how do you go back to having a good sexual relationship? Or if you have a spouse who's been a drug and alcohol addict, or who's had sexual addiction, or who's had an affair, and your trauma response about what happened between you comes up when he just takes your hand, when she just opens up her phone, or when you're just walking along the road, or when you're having sex. That trauma response will come up right in the middle, and it's sometimes a response that's from what's happened between the couple. So without explaining the whole thing, that's a lot of the work that I do. As far as just answering that question of what do I do as a sex therapist, that's actually what I help couples do, is how do you work through that trauma response when it happens in the middle of your relationship and your marriage. The other area that's out of the DSM is gender dysphoria. This is the big one out there in our culture right now. So this would be where I'm not sure what gender I am. I didn't put the DSM in here because I actually showed it a couple weeks ago. But gender dysphoria is the feeling of I'm in a boy's body, but I feel like I'm a girl. I'm in a girl's body, but I feel like I'm a boy, in very simple forms. So I really appreciate the work of Mark Yarhouse, where he talks about identity, both gender identity and sexual identity. So this is, am I same-sex attracted? He's from a Christian standpoint, and he does the formation of the sexual interest and the sexual attractions. How does that, because I get asked that all the time. So funny, I teach with Guy sometimes, or we've been in, at least in the same audience, and people will be asking Guy Hammond different questions. And somebody said, so Guy, you know, explain, you know, how does this develop? And he goes, well, I can tell you my story. He goes, but then you can actually send all those questions to Jennifer. Well, that's the area that I specialize in, is the development of sexuality. As far as, because I'm in the field of psychology, and so it's important, it can be helpful to understand that formation. That what Yarhouse talks about is that people will focus on a different area of sexuality, what's important to them. Their biological, that would be their DNA, or how they identify, meaning how they feel about being a girl or a boy. The persistence of attraction is a part of it, like I am attracted to, and it persists and it continues over years. And then behaviors would be, then I act on that attraction. And then what he does that's very unique, because he comes from a Christian standpoint, is how people do pull in what he calls a valuative framework, which means they pull in their beliefs and their values and decide, although I might have these attractions, or I might have this pull towards being a male or female, although that might be the case, I'm bringing in my beliefs to decide if I'm going to identify that way. I might feel these attractions, but I'm not going to identify as that because of my beliefs. So Yarhouse has a number of books out there. They're pretty hefty in language, but if that's something more that you'd like to read on, that's where I would send you. And so he just talks about how people decide what their identity is going to be, which one of these things do they mostly focus on, or what combination of these do they mostly focus on, what do they give weight to. This is his book. I can't tell you if... Okay. I'm not going to necessarily have you raise hands. But without raising your hand, I want to ask you a question. So don't put your hands up. How many of you own and have read this book? If your hand did not in your mind go up, you need to go over to John's table and buy this book. This is so huge. We have to read from a disciple. He's God's gift to us. And he's going through a lot right now, but we need to utilize what Guy is bringing. We were just texting yesterday, so pray for his wife. I just want to show you some of the questions. So this is our book, Redeemed Sexuality, and these are some of the questions that the singles, campus, and teens have asked me at workshops. Why can't we touch our body if we're not arousing others? It's only our body anyways. Is masturbation a healthy outlet since the Bible doesn't say anything about it? Am I sinful if I dream about having sex even though I'm not having sex? Is it sinful? My spouse left me when my kids are gone. Who's going to meet my physical needs for hugs, etc.? If anyone was sexually active before becoming a Christian but no longer experiences any urge for sex since, is that normal? How do I deal with the fact that I feel validated when others find me physically attractive? I started doing pornography as a 14-year-old and then had early experiences of sex. How do I correct the thoughts that still go through my head? How do we get away from doing pornography when each time I keep saying it is the last time? If arousal is considered natural, this was a question written after I had presented, how do you make sure that it is guided by God and not a temptation from Satan? I know the Bible teaches we're not supposed to have sex until we're married. I did, though, and I still feel guilty in God. What should I do? Is homosexuality caused by negative experiences? If we have a negative sexual experience before, how would we change our perspective about sex? I was sexually abused, and in the past, whenever I had sex, my body froze. This is a single individual asking this question. How would I deal with that in marriage? If I successfully control my sexual desire for a good amount of time, is this someone concerned about how they've been clamping down on their sexual desires as a single? Is it possible I'll lose my sexual desire forever? And it was in capitals in their question. Why did I add these? You have these questions. Your kids have these questions. So every one of these is actually answered in our book. I am doing a shameless go buy this book. The best chapter, though, this is the fun chapter. This is the longest chapter. This is just some of the questions. This is only like a third. The best thing in the whole chapter was the chapter written by our brothers and sisters. I had to write a chapter for What Does a Teen Do? And I'm like, I don't know what to write. My kids would kill me because they'll say, you're such a dork mom. You don't even know what teens go through. And I was like, you're right. I'm having this conversation with my kids. They didn't tell me this. But I'm having this conversation with them in my head. And I'm like, I don't know how to write this chapter. And all of a sudden, I thought, I'm not going to write this chapter. And I went to your brothers and sisters who are between 19 and 26. And I asked them four different questions. What was it like for you, you know, having recently been in the teens? Some of them had been disciples and some not as teens. What was it like for you at school? What was it like for you at home? What was it like for you at church? What did you hear? What did you see? What did you experience? Their answers, I tell you, it was so moving to do this. That is one of the chapters in the book, is their exact words. It's so eye-opening. And just, honestly, just amazing. So there you go. All right, this is the part that many of you are like, is she going to get to sexual addiction? Because this is the one we tend to be like, we've got to focus on this. And I agree we do. I just think we have to have a different approach to it. We tend to have the, it's sin, and it is, and we need to repent, and we do. Again, but we've got to teach around sexuality in order to overcome sexual addiction. This is what it looks like. Again, it's not in the DSM. I explained this earlier. Lack of control of these pursuits, despite consequences, sense of well-being, euphoria, feeling unable, unwilling to stop online. This is about cyber sex. Increasingly desiring and spending more time, neglecting doing it, neglecting relationships, feelings of emptiness, distress, and irritability when you can't. So that's the withdrawal symptoms right there. Lying to cover up. Rituals, meaning people set up, say, their computer station in order to engage in masturbation while watching pornography. And then persistent ideas, thoughts, impulses, and images that just come in and they're inappropriate and they don't know what to do with them. It causes anxiety and distress. So this is the main definition, including some of the other things I showed you earlier. This is one of the things that's vital, is what's going on inside of somebody when they have a background in sexual addiction. I am basically a bad, unworthy person. No one would love me as I am. I am such a screw-up. My needs are never going to be met if I depend on others. Sex is my most important need. So that's just a few thoughts that go through people's minds when they have a background in sexual addiction. And honestly, one of the biggest things that they express is feeling completely separated from God because of, especially as Christians who believe that sex is supposed to only be within the marital sexual relationship and they're dealing with sexual addiction, it's the guilt and the shame around it is huge. We do need very specific plans, and we do need to deal with it in really healthy, clear ways. But we have to understand that when we're talking with people and when we're sharing, that we're understanding the depth of distress that this particular challenge brings to people. And, you know, hence the picture, feeling separated from God. So, what is holiness? What is purity? Okay. Well, number one, we have to actually kind of figure out, what do we feel about it? Because, I mean, if you lived somewhere where, if you lived in, we have a friend who was from China, and he showed us a river by his house, and I was like, ah, and it's green, it's like thick yellow green, and it doesn't flow. And he goes, that's the river by my house. I mean, if that's what your water source was, how would you feel about drinking it? We have incredibly wonderful water sources here, right? And we don't see drinking, we've got bottled water here. Like, when you drink it, do you, you know, do you go, oh, this is the kind of water I have to drink. Oh, this pure water, this is the one I have to drink. We don't do that, do we? But we think of sexual purity with this, oh my gosh, it's such a negative thing. And if we would just switch our thinking to be lucky us, right, that we get this pure water. Sexual purity is a beautiful and wonderful thing. So sometimes we just have to switch our thinking about how we view sexual purity, that it's not this constant deprivation. It's actually a privilege and a benefit. So I'm saying that not so that you use it against each other as a weapon, but just to help spur some new thinking about what is purity. What is the biblical sexual ethic, meaning what are we allowed to do sexually? And that's a whole talk in and of itself. But the thing that we tend to do with answering what are you allowed to do is we just say the don'ts. Don't get pregnant, don't wear that, don't watch that, and don't do that. And I'm a parent, and I feel like I could have my son come up and tell you all the things that we said don't. I don't know how good of a job I did on expressing the goods and the beauties. But the reality is, if we only teach the biblical sexual ethic as far as what you're not supposed to do, which, okay, most of the scriptures are on what you're not supposed to do and the damage, yes. But if we're not teaching the incredibly positive things, we're only giving one side of that biblical sexual ethic. So this is actually on the back, the book Redeemed Sexuality, this is the first line on the back of the cover. It's written for singles, campus, and teens, and the first line is, you are a sexual person. And it's vital that we don't think of sexuality only in terms of when you're married, we'll talk about it. That's when we'll talk about sex. We already talked about the rest of this, so. My daughter called me from Africa, and she was in Ghana, yeah. And she says, she didn't call me. She sent me a text. Mom, what are the scriptures about saving sex till marriage? And I'm like, you are across the world, and you're asking me. And I text back, so is this for you or for others? And she texts back, ha, ha, ha. I actually looked up the exact text, and I put it in the book. Ha, ha, ha. actually, it's for, she was at this orphanage there, and she was serving in this orphanage with a bunch of, it wasn't Hope. It was a secular orphanage. And she had these incredible conversations with all these other girls, and they wanted to know, why do you think you should not have sex until you're married? And she wasn't quite sure what to answer. So I took some time, and I answered her question, and I had several of my women friends say, so what did you answer her? Can you send all those scriptures to us? Because in all honesty, sometimes we don't know. We just know like this one scripture or this one, just don't do it. But we don't have any biblical understanding of what it actually says. So this is what's important is there's a book out there. This is written by a female minister, and it's called Good Christian Sex, Why Chastity Isn't the Only Option, and Other Things the Bible Says About Sex. Why chastity, meaning not having sex before marriage, it's not the only option. And guess what her book's about? If you love someone, then it's within God's plan to engage with them sexually. This is written from a Christian standpoint. You need to know what your kids are hearing and what the singles and campus students are hearing, and you need to know what us can be kind of blind to, even if we're married, is that it's being assaulted, this idea of where sex is supposed to occur. Does the Bible teach that you're supposed to wait? It does. But do you even know where it is? Okay, so when someone doesn't wait and they have sex, how does God respond? God made the law that says you stone them if they're caught in adultery. God wrote that law. He wrote it through his prophets, right? They bring a woman caught in adultery before Jesus and say, hey, it says stone her. What are you supposed to do? So God, who wrote the law, is live on stage, and what does he do? You are free from sin. Go, leave. I don't condemn you. Go leave your life of sin. This, so he who wrote the law that said, throw the stone, said, actually, let me show you how to live this out. That's God live on stage. We need to imitate him and say, God doesn't condemn you. I don't condemn you, but you do need to leave your life of sin. Jesus was just the perfect example. What do we do with shame? It's huge in sexuality. I just put that one word in there because I just want to tell you I'm not ignoring it, but it would be a whole workshop in and of itself. It's actually one of the biggest reasons why people get involved in sexual addiction, because we hide sin. When I did a research study where I interviewed 8 different women, and I did the research study. I presented it at a conference. It won a national award. They're all your sisters that were a part of this. All of them, every single one, some of them growing up in disciple families, some of them growing up in religious families, some of them growing up in, no, all of them grew up with some kind of religious background, did not have a family in which they could talk openly about sexuality. That's within our fellowship, okay? We have, the biggest thing that's correlated with shame isn't actually necessarily all of the things people have done sexually. One of the biggest things, correlated means it has to do with it, it's connected to it. One of the biggest things that's connected to shame is that we don't talk openly about it. So starting in our families, we have to talk openly about sexuality. We just don't have a lot of time. Okay, we have this idea that pornography is a male thing, that women don't struggle with this. That is not true. We need to start having support groups. This is the action plan for those involved in sexual addiction. Put protections on devices, gain a godly view of sex. This is out of Douglas Rosenau's book, Celebration of Sex. He says, make that body, you're looking at a person. When you're looking at somebody and you're tempted to have a lustful thought about them, would I want someone looking at my brother, sister, dad, friend, child like this? And he says, here's his stuff. When you are at the mall and you notice an attractive woman, look at her face and notice if she's tired. Observe the packages she's carrying and think, I bet she's a great mom. Make the woman a person and give her a life. So this is the opposite of objectification. Whether it's a pornographic objectification or it's just somebody at your work or somebody that's walking down the sidewalk, it's vital that we make people real and have real lives. So having a specific action plan, this actually applies to all of the addictions, but specifically to sexuality, we have got to have a different way of viewing the very images or the very things we're looking at. He or she is a student, a parent, an employee, a friend. And continued on the action plan, have a solid one. In other words, we already talked about accepting arousal, like, there it is. Bring in your values. Think about who you're going to call for support when you're pulled towards pornography or any other kind of sexual pursuit. You might need to do something that's a distraction. If you've never read, again, Guy Hammond wrote a book, 60 Seconds Tempt Away. It's hilarious. It's also for sale. John's like over here on the book table. It is so funny. He talks about, he Steve Martin, a wild and crazy guy. So whenever he's pulled towards a sexual thought that he doesn't want to have, he gets up and does the wild and crazy guy. It's called a distraction technique. It's actually used in psychology as well. But we need to do it sometimes to get our brain off of that. So yes, that's a part of it. I love this one. This is out of another book that you'd have to ask me the title of it. It's a great book for singles. And she talks about how write a journal to your future spouse. So there are, you have to have some specific ideas of how you're going to overcome the pulls towards pornography. I do work with couples. That's a whole separate thing. I'm just nodding to that right there. And married couples. This was a question from one of the singles in my workshops. Why don't the married couples talk to the singles about sex? Those of you who are married, please open up the conversations. Find a way to do it. It's awkward. But they have all of these questions. This was also in their questions. They asked about oral and anal sex. They asked about masturbation and pornography. They asked about all those things I just read to you. So take the time to open up the conversations. How can we change, say, specifically pornography addiction? Why do we flee? Because you were bought at a price. Jesus is worth it, right? I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. That is our reason. It is 10:45. I'm going to take 3 minutes of questions. So go for it. Tell me, this is all in sexuality. Go for it. Yeah.
How do we repair damage that's done to our children by not talking about this?
Yeah, thank you. You are awesome. That's like sincere humility. You're talking about your friend, right?
Yeah.
Go buy the book. I'm sorry. I don't mean that as a go buy Redeemed Sexuality. Show your kid that chapter and say, was this your experience? What was your experience? Was it like this? It's just an easy way to start the conversation. I'm reading this book. I was told to read this book. And then I hit this chapter and I just thought, huh. And I wondered, could you read this page? Just read this one page and tell me. So it's actually already laid out there for you on how to have that conversation. Yeah. Ah, so will they, right? I think share what helps you. You know, I know that we're talking about this. Sometimes it can kind of get the juices flowing. In fact, maybe even as we're talking, sometimes the body will respond even when you're starting. And so that might happen for you. So I wonder, do you have like a plan on what you do? Because I know this is what I need to do. This is what I've had to do in the past. And I want, you know, so have a conversation on what do you do. So I'm a therapist, and I train other therapists to be sex therapists, and one of the things we talk about is what do you do when actually you're sitting with somebody doing sex therapy and your body starts to get aroused? Because that happens just by talking about sexuality. So a part of it is, ah, there it is. Like that can happen. And then so when that happens for you, what do you do with it? This is what I know I've found helpful. And have a good conversation for that, so that when they leave, they've got some kind of idea in mind. Yeah. One more. Yeah.
How do you even start a conversation with singles about sex? Is it like just...
You can use this today. Yeah. Do you have it? Because sometimes there are young men who will, they won't talk to another male. So you might be somebody that they'll talk to. That might create some funny stuff, though. So that's just honestly on a get input basis. But I have had young men ask me, sit down at my table and call me and say, Jennifer, I know this is the area you specialize in, and I really have some questions. Can we sit down? And I ask them, do you want to sit down with me and my husband? Would that make you more comfortable? But the main thing being, when it comes to even opening that question, is just to remember that just by asking it, you're telling them it's okay to talk about it. They might not bring it up. They might go, no, I'm good. But just the fact that you asked it can be helpful. We don't have any more time. But I just want to let you know, this is what I'm talking about as far as the books. Actually, our sister in Christ designed both of these. Beth Weeks designed both covers. This is the married one. If you're married, get it. This is for everybody. This doesn't mean it's if you're married, this isn't for you, because this has all the stuff on parents. Plus, Redeemed Sexuality has a lot more on dealing with your own background. There is some of that in Art of Intimate Marriage, but there's a lot more in Redeemed Sexuality. That's it. It's been lovely.
I didn't have a question. I actually, the way I talk about it, I said, well, talk about it like it's food.
See you next Saturday.
When we start talking about...
Oh, yes. Next Saturday is on... It's next Saturday.
Last class.
What do you do with all this?
Yeah. So that's what I was going to share.
Yeah, talk about food.
We had
yes.
Because because when you talk about food and you start, oh my God, and blah. If you talk about sex, like you talk about food.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, that's hilarious.
It was really helpful. People looked at me weird, but they thought, oh.
Yeah, because it normalizes it.
That this is kind of a normal conversation to have. It's so awesome. I love that.
Well,
I use it.
That's what I wanted to share.
Use it.
Okay. All right. I'll take this.
Start pulling.
Oh, this?
Yeah.
Woo!
There it is.
There we go.
I'll give you both.
Thank you. I'll give that to Tim.
Thank you.
No, you gave me a card. I couldn't find it for one second.
I don't know. I did miss it. Right in the very front, the very first article right on the front page. Just put that. I was there yesterday. It's still there.
But they were there last week too, right?
Yep.
Okay, I don't know how
to do that. I mean, I don't know what to say.
Oh, okay.
I can pull up my website right now and say, see that button?
Okay. What is it called?
No. I don't know. This is the name of the class. A Christian counselor wishes to have any questions.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thanks.
I thought it maybe call me while you're on your computer.
Hey, bro, I wanted to say thanks for the message last week.
Oh, you're welcome.
You know what? It really helped me when you mentioned about how God sees us through Jesus.
Yeah.
And He sees us as righteous when we don't see us.
Right.
And that, you know, we'll get the rise, but He sees us righteous.
Right.
And so,
right. Becoming what He sees us as already. It's a very helpful thought.
Becoming, yeah. So I'll
be free from guilt, right?
Do you have a book on that?
Would
you recommend that? Would that be
that one? I'm sure that Linda talks about that. Just give a look at that one, see what you think.
Return to sender, address unknown. No such
It is Linda Brumley, so it has to be a gold nugget.
All right. 13.
Yes. How long did you think it's going to be? Do you want to go to school or change the
curriculum? Oh my gosh.
I saw the topic.
John.
The first three classes are there, this class will be there by tomorrow. And hopefully Jennifer's going to send me the PowerPoint, because I think the notes are very important. The PowerPoint.
How are you?
Huh?
Thanks, guys. I don't want to bug her. I've got more. I've got all kinds of different ones. There you go. Take two more. Yeah. But if you, I've got a variety of other ones if you want. Send me an email and I'll bring extra ones. Yeah.
What do you read?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a few like that.
Oh, just. Yeah, I read books like that. It's sort of junk. Not junk, really, but not. Not. Right. Just reading something for the fun of reading. I do that on a regular basis. Otherwise, because reading hard stuff all the time, I eventually go to not enjoy reading. I just finished a book that I'm writing just yesterday, actually, and there's not so much reading.
All right, good.
Any other? He's got five books that including this one. Yeah, she ran out of time. They ran out of time. You're actually supporting our ministry. When you buy the cards. So I put that. I'll put that in a different card. So I don't forget. She'll be sorry. All right. Yes. Especially this card.
Thank you.
We're going to see it tonight, right? At Lester's? We'll see you tonight at the Lester's? Great.
Return of the sender.
Great. $13.99 plus 8, which would be 21. Now let's say.
Yeah, that's hard.
14 versus 22. Let's say 20. So $2 off for a good guy. Yes. I have to remember that I have to remember zero to me. I haven't done it yet. My parents sold a house once. And the bank just handed out a check for $500,000. Accidentally they added a zero. So they wrote him a check for $5 million instead. My parents passed it, not realizing what had happened. Neither. Josiah is like the grandson of Hezekiah. Josiah is the last good king. He ruled like 640 BC, 630 BC. And Hezekiah was around 720 BC. David was more like 970. Direct great grandson of David. Hezekiah was maybe the 7 or 8 generations after David. And Josiah is like 2 generations after. Yes. And then I believe maybe to Josiah.
No.
It's, I mean, they would call his son like the Messiah is David's son. That was common Jewish way of saying things. I sold my last copy. I've got this little. This is the one thing you brought. We could get, but the other one I'll bring more next week. I only had 3 of these. I didn't realize she was going to do this.
Sorry.
I would have brought more. I should have more at my house. I'm carrying down the market. Sorry. I'll hopefully have more next week. Yeah.
Lillian.
What do you mean, Lily?
Lilith.
Yeah, that's a Jewish name used in Jewish literature. Well, see, the Jews kind of added to the story, and part of their addition to the story involves Lilith. It's very, very much, no, it's not the Bible, but it's very, very much part of the Jewish tradition about the garden. But Lilith is not in the Bible. Lilith is not in the Bible. But, for example, you've heard of C.S. Lewis, the great?
Yes.
Lilith is one of the characters in his sort of biblical trilogy. So if you do a search on Lilith, you'd be tempted to think that she's in the Bible.
Okay,
pops a lot of Jewish discussion. Not
okay. Yolith is, to me, a nice name, but I'm not the source of baby names. All right, we have a brand new granddaughter, and her name is Lorraine. Lorraine is kind of a sort of old-fashioned but beautiful name. Some of these old-fashioned but beautiful names are making a comeback.
And you're a blessing. She was helping.
Yeah.
she wouldn't be able to do this if she didn't have
the. No, that's what she's saying. Honey, I couldn't do this. I wouldn't have done this without you.
Yeah. Who's going to cook when you're going to school? Because my when I went for my certification, I wanted to be at 16, and it happened at 20 something.
Yeah.
You know, there's nobody in my family. They're like, that's stupid for you. Why are you not that stupid?
I want to talk to you.
But my husband, he's for me, it's a year. I'm going to be okay.
There were no jobs in Mexico, so.
Where's the other one, the big one? I sold out. I'll try to bring some next week.
Okay.
I think I have
it.
Good.
Yes.
All
right. How much are they?
14. And that's the this is Park.
Yes, I know. That's the one that we have.
Yep.
And I like this.
Yes, I got copies just 2 days ago. Yes. I didn't have it. All right, so am I okay to put stuff away? Good. We'll be back next week.
All right, I'll see you.
Yep.
Sister,
you know, thanks. I'm actually, I'm not a perfectionist by nature at all, so when it comes to dealing with books, I'm kind of a perfectionist. Well, they go a certain way, if you don't, they tend to either not fit or the books are there. When people offer help, I say, hey, no, thank you.
I mean, I kind of suspect you that, honestly. And so I was actually expecting that to be like, that doesn't like my son, and I'll like that. Yeah. I know he's struggling, but I got it. Or, you know, I would just feel bad that, like, I knowing that I didn't try at all, because I come to stress that I really want to hold you, I feel like.
No, I don't. I feel like I give everything, so I don't feel bad about
that. $20. I just go online and like register.
I don't know where you're getting the name.
Oh, hello.
So, remember, Liz is breathing fire.
Wait, are you going to
No, but
she's she's perfectly game. She's like, I can't commit any time to help you. My mom died. She has 2.5 weeks to
Oh, really?
She's
yeah. Well, we hang out a lot, so sometimes she has to
change
with the baby. Yeah.
And so she's out here every day.
So
it's really hard.
Or was it with Japan?
It was for me, it was great. I don't know about everyone, but
I love games.
But then it's
Yeah, right. I ran out of the carrying on the margins. I think I have one or two more, but I'm not even sure.
No.
All right.
I have
some. Well, I'm sure I've sold at least 30, maybe 40 of them. And I get them 4 or 5 at a time. So
yeah, no, you get more.
It would get a little crazy pretty fast.
So if we want to leave the cables up or put them back?